find the defendants incredibly guilty.
Find this ultimate chicken sandwich on brioche bun to be guilty of being delicious.
Right.
What section of the Constitution has been breached?
There is no one section. It's just the vibe of the thing.
Objection, Your Honor.
What?
He's leading the witness.
Say.
Break, we're both lawyers.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
And welcome to Opening Arguments, episode 259. How's it going, Andrew Torres?
It is going fantastically well, Tom Smith. How are you?
Doing well. I think the fans will be delighted to hear your deeper, congested, sexy lawyer voice. It's always... Why would that... Okay, question for the evolutionary biologists. Why do we sound sometimes better when we're, like, sick? Everybody's always like, yeah. Ooh, nice, sexy... What? That signals to everybody else that we're actually ill, but somehow it's more attractive. But anyway, just a question to ponder. You know, I like to pose questions to other disciplines, like physicists who came to my aid to let us know how fast you were traveling.
That's absolutely worth pointing out that we got, I don't know, 24 physicists who wrote in that say essentially I am traveling at 95% of the speed of light.
Yeah.
So
that's pretty
there
fast.
There we go. That's for the time dilation.
That's so, pretty good, Andrew. I'm impressed. I would have thought you could only get to, you know, maybe 80% of the speed of light. I never would have thought 95%. All right.
You think I'd be burning more calories at that velocity, but apparently not. So
you're just burning up on reentry. But other than that, all right. We've got a lot to talk about today. Probably some one weird tricks that happened with the House Oversight Committee, plus all the document requests. I think Andrew's read most of the words of the known universe in order to prepare on all these document requests. And we're going to talk a little bit about Jeffrey Epstein. So lots of meaty, heavy, weighty topics. We'd better get going.
Yeah, let's get to it.
I'm asking you if you know the difference between right and wrong.
Maybe. Maybe not. Maybe yourself.
Okay, and Andrew was right. I love these. I know I give you a hard time when you're wrong just for fun, but I do love when you're right, actually. So what were you right about?
Yeah, breaking as we are recording, Michael Cohen, this is a CNN report, has produced documents to the House panel. They have not been made public. And it is exactly what I said was coming next, which is the drafts of the various changes in his testimony before Congress that ostensibly will show that that Jay Sekulow, the President Trump's second personal attorney, changed his testimony in order to get him to lie to Congress. Again, we haven't seen the documents. We don't know what they show, but, you know, it shows the kind of foolishness of the White House and Jay Sekulow in coming out and instantly denying something for which it was pretty. I mean, this was not, you know, I don't want to take a huge victory lap here.
Well,
it's a pretty easy thing to call.
Well, to be fair, though, we had somebody, I can't remember where, maybe you saw it. I don't know if it was our, you know, one or two MAGA listener that we have, but we had somebody, I think, chiming back at you and saying, hey, if Cohen had this, it would have already been in the original. Like when he went to testify, he would have already turned it over or presented it. And not so, it sounds like.
Yep. And again, keep in mind that this is part of how investigations proceed, sometimes deliberately, sometimes just by happenstance, where, you know, part of how you test the truth of witnesses is by or non-witnesses in this case is by seeing what they say when you reveal part but not all of the information that you have in your possession. And certainly looks like Cohen wrangled them in on this one. So I may have to knows my estimation of his capability upward just a tick. But there we go.
Well, he did pass the bar. He used to be a lawyer. Not anymore.
And he's the taxi king of New York. So
yeah, well, that's kind of a point against what we're talking about. That's okay. Yeah. All right. Well, so then why do you think they were denying it if it would be so easy to... Yeah, that does still worry me a little bit. I mean, it doesn't...
Yeah, well, the reason they're denying it is because, that right, suborning perjury is a crime. So,
yeah.
You know, I don't... I...
But then, I mean, aren't they making it worse if they deny
you would think
on...
they would be
well,
making
are they going to make
I mean...
the argument... I think we kind of talked about this, where it's going to be some... Oh, well, I wasn't... We just changed it for time. We edited it for style. It wasn't anything to do with suborning perjury. We just, you know... Thought it would be that would flow a little better if we edited the statement this way.
Yeah, I think it look, it will depend on what the drafts show, right? I mean, obviously, a smocking
like,
gun
it was
would
an
be...
iambic pentameter, and we changed it to the meter wasn't right.
Right. So, look, if there's handwriting on there that pretty clearly matches secular, right? Like that would be, you know, the aforementioned
please
smocking
perjure.
Gun.
Make sure.
But if Cohen has six different drafts saved on his computer, right? Wow. Like, you know, they can certainly turn around and go, well, you know, he just edited that himself. But, you know, that I mean, that's the kind of testimony that juries evaluate all the time. And if you were sort of comparing between, no, I just completely changed these words here because I changed my mind about it. You know, that's a tough inference to overcome. So
all right.
We'll see.
We will see. We'd better get to our main segment, which I think definitely calls for some yodeling. What do you think?
I totally agree.
Because people have got to know whether or not their president is a crook.
Nobody so you're not aware of any context look, during look, the course look. Of the election?
How many times do I have to answer this question?
Can you just say
Russia
yes or no
is
on
a
it?
Ruse. Yeah, I know you have to get up and ask a question. So important. Russia is a ruse.
Well, I'm not a crook.
All right, Andrew, document requests. We got document. Guys, I'm reminded of the old David Letterman letters. We got letters. We got lots and lots. We got lots and lots of document requests. So how's that going? How's your reading?
Treating I love you? That. I love that old David Letterman segment. That's great.
You had a lot of good bits.
Yeah. So yeah, Congressman Nadler released 81 sets of document requests and accompanying letters, and I have read them all. I'm going to provide the link in the show notes. And one of the things that happens, this is going to be really, really instructive in a lot of different ways, right? So the first way in which it's really instructive is how lawyers go about serving this kind of discovery, right? And even though the House Oversight Committee has attorneys that they have hired specifically for this purpose, right, to help them out on these sorts of investigations, you still don't just, when you need to serve document requests on 81 different people, you don't start writing from scratch every time, right? Like you write out a master list of documents that you want, and then you pick and choose who you're going to ask the specific requests of, right? And the reason that you do it that way is because if you just have a single boilerplate list and you send it out to people, then they can object to the production and in fact kind of demonstrate to a potential court that, you know, you're not being careful with how you are issuing these document requests, right? So let me give you a really, really obvious example. If you have a White House staffer that left before a certain event, and one of the things you want to know is, for example, details of Donald Trump's meetings with Vladimir Putin, you wouldn't include on that list the meetings between Trump and Putin that occurred after that person left the White House, right? So you go through and you take that master list and then cull the individual items that apply to each individual person. And in fact, if you do what I did and you go through all 81 of these document requests, you will see, right, hilarious typos and oversights and things that they meant to do. So for example, one of the documents has a formatting error such that instead of it being 1ABC, 2ABC, 3ABC, it is AABC, BABC, CABC. Right. Again, it's just the kind of thing that happens when you need to put together hundreds of pages in a really, really short period of time. We've talked about this before with inadvertent production and stuff like that. Now, having said all that, what do you think, knowing that these documents went out to all of the big players in the Trump administration, in the Trump campaign, remotely connected, you know, people like Donald Trump Jr. and Eric Trump and, you know, White House counsel Don McGahn and Michael Flynn and Michael Cohen and all of that. Who do you think got the most complete set of documents?
Got the
set of documents that had the most items included on it from that sort of master list.
And when you say got, you mean they were targeted to.
Yes. Right. Was served. Okay.
Yeah,
with
I wasn't sure if you're asking like who received that. Documents yeah. or who was.
No. Was asked to produce the largest set of documents.
Who would they ask to produce the largest set of documents? Gosh, I'm not sure I'm picking up who that would be. I don't know if I mean, who would get the largest thing of documents? I'm going to say like, well, is it going to be counterintuitive? Like you wouldn't want Trump to give you a bunch or you would want, or like the Trump Foundation. Ooh, is it one of the people that kept getting named over and over as the two other people from the Trump org? I'm going to go with one of them.
all of those are great guesses. I was deliberately asking a question I thought you couldn't answer.
Okay.
And indeed, you
couldn't.
And
you were right that I couldn't be right. Thank you.
but weirdly, the person with the largest set of these document requests that applies to her is Hope Hicks.
Huh. Yeah. No, I wasn't going to guess that.
Yeah. It's interesting.
It's interesting.
She has a larger set that applies to her than even to Donald Trump Jr.
So do you think that's because she's in an interesting intermediate space between, you know, hasn't been charged that I know. She hasn't been indicted that I know of. And also she doesn't seem like she's too in with the Trump, you know, like she's not defensive. Like it might be a good place to get documents and get accurate information, or is it just happens to be she has custody of the most things, or what's the explanation?
I think the former is exactly right.
Okay.
Right, like you will see as we go through this, and look, we're not going to go individual by individual. I would be recording here till the weekend, but for example, Paul Manafort has a limited set of documents, mm-hmm. and the reason that they've set out a limited request of documents from Paul Manafort is they know he's going to stiff him anyway.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, that's not a valuable source to the House Oversight Committee. It's still worth doing your due diligence and, you know, making his lawyers produce stuff and all of that. But you look, you know, there's a document request out there to Julian Assange and to WikiLeaks, right? Like that, they're never getting anything from those sources.
Yeah, they're all about transparency. WikiLeaks is until it's them, and then no transparency.
Yeah. So you were exactly right that what you're trying to find is the sweet spot of people who have responsive documents but are not either so blindly loyal to Trump that it's not worth going after it, or on the other hand, right, you know, like, look, they've made a lot of requests of Michael Cohen as well, and, you know, they know they're going to get that, but they have most of those documents mm-hmm. already. So now, what are they asking for? And this is really, really important to know as this unfolds. As of right now, the primary documents that are being requested, and they're being requested that all of these parties turn them over within 2 weeks. But the limitation is that, and I'm going to read directly from the instructions here, In order to facilitate the production of documents on an expedited basis, you may limit your production at this time to documents you furnished at any time after November 8th, 2016, that is after the election, to the special counsel's office, to the Southern District of New York, to any other federal regulatory or law enforcement agency, to any congressional committee, or in any civil or other litigation. Right? This includes, but is not limited to, documents that were voluntarily provided, produced under compulsion, or seized. So what does that mean? That means that what the Congressional Oversight Committee is doing here is a continuing theme that we've talked about on OA, and that is they are decentralizing the Mueller investigation. They are gathering all of the documents that have been produced independently so that they're under the control of the committee, so that, as we said from the beginning of this year, right, it's way too late to try and stop, you know, to try and put the genie back in the bottle. There are separate investigations that are beyond their control. And now these documents will be under the control of the Democratic House Oversight Committee.
So do you think they'll be able to unlock, like, what percentage, if you're, you know, if we're looking at the congressional investigation, the House investigation versus the Mueller investigation, you know, who could possibly unlock more? And if so, like, what's the proportions? You know, are there tools that the special counsel have that Congress wouldn't be able to make use of, or vice versa?
Yeah. And the answer is, as of right now, the parties that are blazing the trails are coming out of the special counsel's office, right? This is not going to blaze any new trails.
Okay.
This is, and let me give you a really, really good example of that. And for now, right? We'll get back to sort of what happens when Mueller winds down. But we've talked about how all of these document requests, how the superset went to Hope Hicks. Hope Hicks now works for Fox, right? And there was information that came out a couple of days ago that suggested that Fox was involved in killing the Stormy Daniels story, right? That they had it, and that internally somebody sent a message that said, hey, Rupert Murdoch wants Trump to win, so don't run this story.
And fed Trump the debate question or whatever, the same as that too.
Yeah. And that's all right. And none of those questions are addressed to Hope Hicks. Right. So, in other words, this is meant, and it's why I want to go over this very, very carefully. This is meant to consolidate and bring into the public the information that so far has really been kind of leaking out in dribs and drabs. It is not meant to start new investigatory threads at this time. Right now, once the Democratic committee has certain sets of documents, if they learn things that we don't know, because right now they don't know much more than you and I know, right? They've had some closed door testimony with Michael Cohen. They've probably had some back channeling. So there are things that they know that we don't know. But it isn't like kind of peering into the special counsel's office, which I've treated as a black box, right? Mm-hmm. Remember, I mean, when we had AG on, we looked at kind of the entire gamut of there could be, we could know 1%, we could know 95%, right? I tend to think it's closer to the 1% side of the equation.
All right. I tend to think it's closer to the 95%.
Yeah, well, we'll find out. This will be a fun prediction.
I would say, yeah, I put it at like 60-70%. That's what I'd say.
So closer to, and I probably put it at like 30. So, you know,
neither of us are that committal on.
Right. We want to be right on this. So at this stage, this is not going to uncover really any new information other than some of the things that I'm about to tell you.
But doesn't it give you the advantage? Because back in the old days, you know, back when, I would say, you know, when the Yodel Mountain guy would talk about back in the old days, you used to not do a press conference where you gave the results of an investigation unless you were pressing charges. So, for example, just as a wild hypothetical, if you were investigating Hillary Clinton's email use, and you found she didn't do anything wrong, criminal, and you weren't charging her, you'd be like, okay, done with that. That'll just go away. Nobody talks about it. But in this day and age, you know, you never know. But is the benefit of this the fact that if Mueller were to honor, you know, pre-Comey precedent, which means when you don't charge somebody with something, you don't do a clown-horning press conference to affect the election. Does that mean then they can kind of, the congressional investigation can kind of pick up the pieces and bring to light any political type malfeasance that doesn't quite reach the level of breaking the law?
That's exactly right. I could not have said it better myself. That is 100% what the objective here is. And it also has the advantage of taking the decision out of the hands of Trump's attorney general, right? Because Mueller is going to deliver his report to Bill Barr. We have said here on the show, right, that there is some reason for optimism and that the discussion of Bill Barr in the like furthest, you know, sort of neo-occupy Democrat circles of refusing to commit to publicly releasing all of the Mueller report was actually a prudent thing for a smart lawyer to say and not necessarily ominous. But if you're worried about the downside, right, this helps protect you against the downside.
Can I just say and get your view on this? It pretty much would have been like game over, man, if we had lost the midterm, right? I mean, maybe something would have still gotten out, but it would have been catastrophic. Just a reminder to everybody who went and voted and worked hard to get people to vote for the midterms. I know sometimes it doesn't feel like Andrew always says, the holding action thing, but that was huge. It was absolutely huge to have control of the House right now.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. And that was why, you know, when we got together right after the election, you know, and people were still sort of sorting through the, was it a wave? Was this a bit, you know, you and I were like, look, it cannot be overstated how significant it was to retake the House. You know, yeah.
So good job, everybody.
Yes, absolutely. And good pointing that out. So now let's talk about the buckets of questions that are being asked here, because I break them down into a couple of different categories. And again, I'm going to link Hope Hicks's document requests in the show notes, because she's got almost all of them. There are only a handful of questions that don't show up on her document requests, and we may talk about those. The ones under item number one, which have 13 sub elements on it, are all about the Trump administration covering up evidence of collusion with Russia. Right. So these are requests. And again, remember, all of these are requests for documents. Right. Congress has inherent subpoena power. If a party declines to produce documents, then Congress can go back and issue a subpoena. Failure to comply with the subpoena is punishable by contempt of Congress, right? Lots of people are not going to comply with these subpoenas, and there will be litigation over it. That's coming down the road. But plenty of people are going to comply with these document requests. So item number one is the bucket of things that relate to what our Republican friends are calling process crimes and what we might call core Nixon crimes, right? The cover-up is worse than the crime itself.
Kinds of crimes that Roger Stone has tattooed on him. Those kinds of crimes.
Yes. Yeah, exactly right. So documents about communications between Don McGahn and Trump on January 26, 27, 2017, relating to Michael Flynn's statements to the FBI, right? The resignation, termination of Michael Flynn, President Trump's contacts with James Comey, communications involving a group of people, including Rod Rosenstein, Jeff Sessions, Jared Kushner, related to the Rosenstein memorandum to Sessions entitled Restoring Public Confidence in the FBI. That's all the work that went into firing Comey, right? A specific request on firing Comey. Hmm. An interesting request on that is described as meetings or discussions in and around May 2017 involving the FBI and or Department of Justice relating to the termination of James Comey, including but not limited to those involved involving Rod Rosenstein and Andrew McCabe, at which any of the following were discussed: obstruction of justice, surreptitious recording of the president, or the 25th Amendment. You may recall when that story came out that said, you know, Rod Rosenstein had sort of joked about invoking the 25th Amendment.
Yeah, or not joked.
Right, right. And apparently Congress at least thinks that that's worth investigating. That's I thought that that was sort of interesting. Anyway, I could go through the rest of these. There's a document request for any documents related to possible pardons for Paul Manafort, Michael Flynn, or Michael Cohen. So all of these kind of fall into that first bucket of cover up by the administration after the investigation was already underway. And the key witnesses, we can talk about who these people are when we get to the individual section. The key witnesses who have information about this, other than kind of the keys to the whole kingdom, we'll talk about who those people are. But the people who uniquely have evidence as in the eyes of Congressman Nadler are Jay Sekulow, who is not going to turn over any information. He's the president's lawyer. He's going to invoke executive privilege. K.T. McFarland and Mark Corallo. Put a pin in those two names because we will come back to them. The second category of documents for which the Congressional Oversight Committee seeks documents are related to AMI, Michael Cohen, and Stormy Daniels, Catch and Kill. That's pretty straightforward. That goes to what we said from the very beginning of our Stormy Daniels is a Legal Genius episode. This is serious, and the threads are starting to unravel on very obvious campaign finance violations that go all the way to the top of the Trump campaign.
Hey, listeners, today's show is brought to you by Robinhood. Robinhood is an investing app that lets you buy and sell stocks, ETFs, options, and cryptos, all commission-free. While other brokerages charge up to $10 for every trade, Robinhood doesn't charge any commission fees, so you can trade stocks and keep all of your profits. Plus, there's no minimum account deposit needed to get started, so you can start investing at any level. The simple, intuitive design of Robinhood makes investing easy for newcomers and experts alike. View easy-to-understand charts and market data, and place a trade in just 4 taps on your smartphone. You can also view stock collections, such as 100 most popular. With Robinhood, you can learn how to invest in the market as you build your portfolio, discover new stocks, track your favorite companies, and get custom notifications for price movements so you never miss the right moment to invest. Robinhood is giving listeners of Opening Arguments a free stock like Apple, Ford, or Sprint to help build your portfolio. Sign up at arguments.robinhood.com. That's arguments.robinhood.com.
Now, is that going to be enough to impeach a president standing alone? You know, we will have to find out. But I think that this sort of falls into the category that you were describing at the outset of, notwithstanding where somebody might bring criminal charges now against the president for failure to disclose certain campaign contributions, this goes at the core of the democratic process, and that will now be in the hands that include the Congressional Oversight Committee. So that's the second bucket. And those witnesses are the Trump Organization folks that that you alluded to, right? Alan Garten, Alan Weisselberg, Ronald Lieberman, a guy named Bradley Crate, who was the treasurer of the Trump campaign, as well as AMI folks. So Pecker, Dylan Howard, and Keith Davidson. The next set of document requests, I've broken up. I could break it up even further, but I've just broken it up into two segments here for convenience sake. They're under documents. They're under item number 3, but A through D is really all of number 3 are related to the campaign, right? So if the first category are documents related to behavior by Trump once elected and once inaugurated, then this category is behavior up to the election and up to the inauguration, right? So during the campaign
phase. So we're going backwards in time, you're saying?
Yes, okay. Exactly. Right. They've got our limited use time machine. I hope they do better with it than we do. And A through D, right, are broadly worded, right? So A says, any foreign government discussing offering or providing or being solicited to discuss, offer, or provide any present or emolument of any kind, whatever, on or after November 8th, 2016. Ooh. So after the election, between the election and the inauguration, to Trump, his business interests, the Trump Organization, Jared Kushner, his business interests, Ivanka Trump, her business interests, or, and boy, we need to do a special on this, the 58th Presidential Inaugural Committee. I have alluded to this. There's $100+ million in slush funds in the Presidential Inaugural Committee that has virtually no information attached to it. And the Southern District of New York has already issued a subpoena to the Trump Inaugural Committee. And I really think that there is just a treasure trove to be found out there. We'll have to come back to that. Next, any U.S. federal, state, or local government discussing, offering, or providing, or being solicited to discuss, offer, or provide any emolument after the election to the same group of people, right? C, and this is why I'm going backwards in time a little bit, right? So that is after Trump was elected to the inauguration, when, you know, the billionaire donors sort of lined up to say, "Oh,
they
my gosh,
more than he
won,"
and the inaugural festivities had fewer people and weren't very good. So where did that money go?
Yep, and again, testimony from the guy who put on George W. Bush's inaugural, who said they raised three times as much money and had half as many events. So, you know, again, I'm sure he will be derided as a crazy Democrat off on a witch hunt.
Yeah, of course. But, yeah, this was the fire festival of inaugural inaugurations.
Yeah, that is definitely how we should refer to it. As we move back in time, then we get any loan, financing transaction, or capital investment by the Russian Federation, any Russian national, any Russian business, or any other Russian entity to the Trump Organization, Donald Trump, Ivanka Trump, Jared Kushner, or any of their business interests from January 1, 2015 to the present.
And remind me, so who are they asking for those documents?
So the they are asking,
hey, Putin,
yeah,
could
they're
you...
asking a lot of people for these documents. And I'll give you the full list after I give you D, because D is about Trump Tower Moscow, right? Trump Tower Moscow or any other proposed or possible real estate development in the Russian Federation by Donald Trump or the Trump Organization from January 2015 to the present. So you take those A through D. To me, that's the core kind of bag of money with a dollar sign on it that we talked about at the very beginning of Yodel Mountain, right? What do you have of direct evidence of people buying favors from the president or the president's inner circle? And the people who are specifically targeted in this area are, again, the Trump Org folks, Weisselberg, Garten, some familiar names, or at least one familiar name in George Papadopoulos, and then also some people you have never heard of before, Jason Maloney, Matthew Calamari, Sherry Dillon, and Stefan Passantino. Let me talk about Matthew Calamari for a second. Number one, because as you go through this list, the number of people that like sound like they're in a bad mafia movie, it's hey, I'm Matthew Calamari over here, right? You've got him. You have him. You have Tony Fabrizio, right? Yeah. You've got a lot of folks that all I can say is the movie that's going to come out of this, movies that are going to come out of this, they will probably have to change some of the names to make it seem more realistic, right? So who's Matthew Calamari? Matthew Calamari is a Trump Organization bodyguard who, by the way, when you Google his picture, he looks like George Wendt playing Mike Ditka on Saturday Night Live, right? I mean, that's what he looks like, right? He's a big, burly dude who got elevated from bodyguard to vice president and chief operating officer at the Trump Organization. This is a really odd recurring pattern. We're going to talk about another one of these folks where, again, it seems to reinforce the notion that Trump values blind loyalty above all else, right? Where people who have come in to work in administrative capacities all of a sudden find themselves the, you know, executive vice president of a multi-billion dollar operation. Calamari was Trump's bodyguard when he took a trip to Moscow in 1996. And I'm pulling this from the excellent thread from Seth Abramson, which I will link in the show notes, which I tweeted out on Twitter. Seth notes that that was a trip during which the congressional investigators looking into the Steele dossier believe that the Kremlin collected blackmail on Donald Trump. So Matthew Calamari is asked about, this is really, really interesting. He is asked about the Cohen AMI stuff, right? Catch and kill, and also the bag of money stuff. I have no idea how, right? When you're talking about the Calamaris of the world, right? These are people who obviously have a tremendous loyalty to Donald Trump, right? Guy was working as a bodyguard. Now he's an executive vice president. And I mean no disrespect to bodyguards out of that. But at some point, right, that loyalty is a business loyalty, right? And I feel like those are the kinds of folks that all of a sudden can look around and be like, oh, I'm in way over my head and it's time to bail. And I think that that's probably the most charitable description of Michael Cohen, right? He falls into the same kind of pattern. Not an undistinguished lawyer who was elevated to become general counsel of a multi-billion dollar corporation and was super, super loyal to Donald Trump until he wasn't. These are also people, right? Unlike Paul Manafort, right? Where Paul Manafort may be driven by loyalty to Donald Trump. He may be driven by hope of a pardon. He may also be driven by the fact that he doesn't want to get brutally murdered by Vladimir Putin. There doesn't seem to be any connection between some of these folks, you know, the Calamaris of the world and Vladimir Putin. So that was the third bucket, right? The bag of money with a dollar sign on it bucket. The fourth bucket, and this is the last bucket. And again, you know, we could draw the lines anywhere we want, but I drew them here. Would be anything after the June 9th, 2016 Trump Tower meeting, the changing of the Republican Party platform to be pro-Russia and deleting the language providing assistance to Ukraine, the discussion of lifting sanctions against Russia, including lifting sanctions under the Magnitsky Act. So this is, right, I would put all of these in the bucket of the quid pro quo back to Russia from the Trump campaign, right? Because again, as you really astutely pointed out, we're talking about building a case to the public here. And while you may not be able to build a criminal case without showing both ends of the transaction, right? If you show the Trump campaign being directed from the top down to, you know, respond to instructions from Moscow, I would like to think that that would be persuasive to members of the United States Senate who may happen to be Republicans. I have been disappointed by a lot of Republicans in the past 2 years, so you know, maybe that won't change a whole lot. But this last category also includes the connections to WikiLeaks, right? Conversations between Manafort and Kilimnik, conversations between Michael Cohen and a really confusing set of entities under the name Columbus Nova, which was a financial investing firm that has ties back to Russia. So all of that stuff kind of falls under that last bucket. And the folks who have relevant knowledge in that area are the eight attendees at the Trump Tower meeting, right? As well as a whole host of people, including somebody we paused really, really briefly over, who, if you want kind of advance knowledge of folks whose names you don't know now, but might know in the next couple of weeks, keep this one in your pocket. Randy Credico.
I've heard that name.
Yeah. He is the intermediary.
Oh, is that the one that told Stone or something about?
Yeah. He's the intermediary between Stone and WikiLeaks, right? And when he was cooperating, that's the guy that Roger Stone threatened to go kill his dog.
Yeah, isn't
right?
he a like a comedian or something weird?
Yes. Yeah. He's a weird dude. He's a far left Bernie supporter who nevertheless is friends with Roger Stone and who was believed to have been
we'll call him Mr. Horseshoe Theory, I guess.
Yeah, right. Well, there's no such thing as Horseshoe Theory. But yeah, so Credico is on that list, along with the aforementioned Bradley Crate, not somebody you've ever heard of. The very weird story of Peter Smith, who committed suicide in 2017 and left a suicide note that said there was no foul play here whatsoever. That was interesting.
I don't want to turn into a Seth Rich type conspiracy theorist, though.
Yeah, no, we're not going to do that. But that's who's in that bucket. I want to pause really briefly over the witnesses who have who, like Hope Hicks, got the majority of these document requests directed at them. Right, these are the folks that the Congressional Oversight Committee believes are the major players. And lots of them are people that you would would expect to be on this list. But there are some surprises. At least there were surprises to me. Right. So, for example, I was surprised that Eric Trump and Donald Trump Jr. got the same set of requests. Right. Literally word for word identical. I kind of view Donald Trump Jr. as having having more of an involvement in this. I mean, you know, he was the one at the June 2016 meeting. Right. But they got the same set of requests. Folks who are on this list are for the most part people that you would suspect, right? Steve Bannon, Sean Spicer, Michael Flynn, Michael Cohen, Jared Kushner, the Trumps, Don McGahn, Corey Lewandowski, Carter Page. But there are a few people on there that were new to me, and I want to share those with you. Now, some are semi-new, right? They don't really count, right? So Annie Donaldson, for example, she was chief of staff to Don McGahn. Now, that demonstrates, I think, how critical they think the White House counsel, the former White House counsel, was in possessing all sorts of information relevant to this investigation. You may or may not have heard of Brad Parscale.
Doesn't ring a bell.
He was the digital media director for the Trump 2016 campaign. He's had no role in the administration, but everything to do with the campaign and post-campaign activities, right? That is all of the Cohen AMI catch and kill stuff, plus everything in those last two buckets, right? Bag of money from Russia and quid pro quo back to Russia. He's targeted for all of that. A guy named George Nader, not somebody I had ever heard of, and somebody, in fact, that I tweeted out to Congressman Nadler, I think they accidentally omitted a question from his document request. I think they should have asked him to produce documents related to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, and they didn't. George Nader is... he's a pedophile. Okay. Okay. I'm going to read this from Wikipedia because, as I always do when we are talking about very serious accusations, Wikipedia says Nader has been charged with crimes involving the sexual exploitation of minors and convicted of several of them. A 1985 charge of receiving from the Netherlands films and magazines depicting pre and post pubescent boys engaged in sexual acts was dismissed due to an invalid search warrant. A federal court in Virginia in 1991 gave him a 6-month sentence on a felony charge of transporting from Germany pornographic videotapes of boys about 13 or 14 years old. Prosecutors agreed to put the case under seal due to the extremely sensitive nature of Mr. Nader's work in the Middle East. In 2003, he was convicted in Prague of sexually abusing 10 boys, for which he served 1 year in prison. That's
stop put to this sooner?
Yeah, he is still, I mean, you say sooner, he is a political operative today, right? I could continue to go on, but Eric Prince, don't have time to go through who he is, but he is a major player in all of this. He founded the Blackwater security firm. He hired George Nader to help with contracts with the Iraqi government, identified him in a deposition. Nader, in 2016, right, a decade and a half after being convicted of multiple accounts of sexual abuse of young boys, met with Donald Trump Jr. at Trump Tower to offer his assistance in the Trump campaign. He served as an envoy representing the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, who we have previously discussed on the show, the person who ordered the decapitation and dismemberment of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. That meeting included Eric Prince, the founder of Blackwater. After that, after successfully brokering relations between the Saudi government and the Trump campaign,
Do these people not realize they're in a James Bond style bad guy meeting? Like, this is Transformers level, like, all right, you're evil. That guy's a pedophile. That's pretty evil. Hey, anybody just want to share how evil they are? What do you do? Oh, you dismember journalists. Okay, cool. Welcome to the table.
Yeah. That's who was collaborating with the Trump campaign.
Only hires the best.
Post-election. Yeah. The drain the swamp. He worked with Elliot Broidy, who you may remember as one of Michael Cohen's three clients. He funded a conference criticizing Qatar that was hosted by the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. So I've added them to my list of keep my eyes open when you see, because, you know, Foundation for Defense of Democracies doesn't immediately jump out as, evil organization. Like when you call your security firm Blackwater, right? Like you might as well have the Eye of Sauron on your flag. Like, you know what you're doing. You know what you're getting there. He's a bad, bad dude. And he was served with a subpoena from the special counsel's office in January of 2018, was questioned about the relationship between the Trump campaign and the UAE. And according to Wikipedia, was granted immunity for that investigation. I know, as careful as Mueller has been, I doubt that he got any sort of blanket immunity, but he's somebody who has cooperated before, and he has a ton of document requests directed to him. So look for that name, George Nader. Next up is somebody that I was really shocked that I didn't know this person before. Once I started digging into all of the connections, it's a woman named Rona Graff. She is like Calamari. She is she's Donald Trump's personal secretary, and has been his personal secretary for 30 plus years.
Wow.
And then was made a senior vice president within the Trump organization.
She knows where the emoluments are buried.
She absolutely knows where the emoluments are buried. And the reporting, and again, I'm pulling some of this from, from just the Wikipedia article on her, which says Graff has been nicknamed Trump's right hand. John Castamatis has similarly remarked, if I really wanted to whisper something in Donald Trump's ear, I would probably go to Rona. In a 2004 interview with Real Estate Weekly, Rona Graff said, everybody knows in order to get through to him, they have to go through me. So they're always on their best behavior. And then Wikipedia also notes that Graff has reportedly communicated with Trump through his White House assistant and former deputy chief of staff. Graff's connection in all of this is that she was referred to by name in an email between Rob Goldstone. Rob Goldstone was the person who called the Trump Tower meeting, and Donald Trump Jr. And Goldstone's email to Trump Jr. says, and this is public, "I can also send this info to your father via Rona, but it is ultra sensitive, so I wanted to send it to you first." So she has been at kind of the center of all of this as a gatekeeper, at least up until Trump went into the White House, and potentially, if you know the reports underlying Wikipedia are to be believed, even after Trump became president. Not a name I have seen before.
Yeah.
Really, really interesting when I started digging through it. And again, she is asked everything from prior to Trump assuming office, right? So she's asked about Cohen, AMI, Catch and Kill, and both the bag of money from Russia and the quid pro quo back to Russia. So everything up except for the cover up within the White House.
Once and again, these I think are that's all a name people we're you're see. Saying Mueller has already probably talked to or done all this. This is just backtracking over that.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. That's right.
Interesting.
So, I could keep going for another hour, but you know, I think that we've kind of uncovered the really sort of interesting nuggets here, and yeah. You know, and outlined what the committee is seeking, the documents that we're looking for, how they're going to put those together. And now we need to start thinking about, you know, what is the case with respect to, you know, each of these four buckets as to are we okay as a society, right? Like, start talking to your Republican friends. Are you okay as a society with the president of the United States personally directing potential criminal activities in any of these four areas? Look, number one, right, is the Richard Nixon precedent. You shouldn't be, but already we've got people saying, just process crimes, right? Number two is campaign fraud and silencing critical reports right before an election. Already we've got people going, you know, like who doesn't just pay hush money to their porn star through their lawyer's secret account? Yeah. And then we have both sides of collusion between the campaign and Russia in the form of direct payments to Trump and his inner circle and promises back from the Trump campaign to the Russian government to perform certain favors. And again, look, they're document requests, right? It is possible. Let's make sure that we're skeptical, appropriately skeptical, right? It is possible that the answer to, right, you could serve a document request on me that says, you know, produce all information of any contact between you and Vladimir Putin, right? And then I would write back and go, okay, here I'm enclosing all the documents. Yeah. Here it is, zero. So, you know, the asking a question does not mean the answer to the question is yes, there are documents. But in this case, I think there is a strong inference to be made that these document requests were very, very carefully prepared, vetted. It was not just a single. I mean, I was surprised. I expected it to be a single boilerplate kind of repeated again and again. And it was very carefully culled, right? And the people we've identified are the people that the Congressional Oversight Committee deemed worthy of receiving information in all four buckets. So there you go.
So what's the timeline we're looking at here?
They will get the first sets of documents and or the first objections within 2 weeks by March 18th. So a week and a half by the time this airs.
So we still got a ways to go because I'm sure there's a lot that happens after that. But
yeah, absolutely.
Things are underway. Cool. Well, thanks for doing all that reading so we didn't have to. And I think we'd better see if we can cover our last segment here in relativistic time.
Yes.
Here we go. Opening Arguments is brought to you by Hims, a new wellness brand for men. Did you know that 66% of men lose their hair by age 35? Ugh, tugging at my collar. That the age is coming up fast for me here. But the thing is, when you start to notice hair loss, that's when it's already too late. It's easier to keep the hair you have than to replace hair you've lost. And what blows my mind about Hims is that there are medical solutions based on science that are available for guys, even though some guys just turn to weird solutions or don't do anything when there's actual medicine that you can utilize. ForHims.com is your one-stop shop for hair loss, skin care, and sexual wellness for men. All right, so how it works is Hims connects you with real doctors and medical-grade solutions to treat hair loss. These aren't snake pills or gas station counter supplements. These are prescription solutions that are backed by science. And there's no waiting room. There's no awkward in-person doctor visit. There's nothing worse than having to go to the doctor for something like this and have an awkward conversation, take time out of your day. You can save time and save that awkwardness by going to forhims.com. It's really easy. You just answer a few quick questions and a doctor will review and prescribe you, and those products are shipped directly to your door. And did you know, Hims has quite literally a sister site that is for hers. So that same convenience they are bringing for men's health and wellness products, they are bringing for women's products, that is for hers, and they are bringing convenient and affordable prescription treatments to women for birth control, adult acne, low sex drive, and much more. Our listeners get a trial month of Hims for just $5 today, right now, while supplies last. Restrictions may apply. See website for full details. But this would cost hundreds if you went to the doctor or the pharmacy. Go to forhims.com/OA. That's forhims.com/OA. Forhims.com/OA.
Boo this man! Boo!
So, Andrew, get up to the closest to the speed of light as you can and tell us about this Jeffrey Epstein stuff. Well, can I just say very quickly, first off, I've encountered some of this Jeffrey Epstein news and have looked into it a little bit back when, you know, I talked about the fact that astronomer Lawrence Krauss, or astrophysicist, I guess, Lawrence Krauss was accused of all kinds of sexual harassment and stuff. And it was really disturbing because I hadn't known this until this came up. Lawrence Krauss had defended Jeffrey Epstein in a really, what I think is pretty gross way. And I just wanted to throw that in for anybody who listened to that show. This is that guy I was talking about. So what's going on? What's new with this creep?
Yeah. We're gonna break this down in more detail, for the reasons that I'm about to explain.
Okay.
But on a factual level, the undisputed facts of what Jeffrey Epstein did are horrifying. I mean, we will need to put a trigger warning on that episode. It's awful. I don't want to talk about that right now.
Okay.
I don't want to talk about that ever, yeah. But we will need to. What I want to talk about is the news report that is going around that says his sweetheart plea deal was torn up and that he will be subject to re-prosecution for the sexual abuse of teenage girls.
Because without going into all the stuff, like, he got a ridiculously absurdly good deal that a lot of people think he should not have got.
Yeah, he did. And there was a recent ruling by the court, and that's what I want to break down.
Okay.
But it doesn't quite mean what some people are saying. The reason we are covering it now is because as this airs, by the end of today, Friday, the parties are required to submit supplemental filings, and those supplemental filings will tell us where this is going to go. So I wanted to give everybody kind of a head start, because you're going to see additional reporting starting as early as Friday afternoon, whenever that joint status report is released. And I want to give you the tools to understand what those headlines are going to mean when they come out. So very, very briefly, you have stated it correctly. In 2007, the U.S. Attorney's Office, which was led at the time by current Trump Secretary of Labor Alex Acosta, they negotiated in secret a non-prosecution agreement against Epstein on federal sex trafficking charges, right? And the reason is that, as we've talked about before, sexually abusing an underage girl is a state law crime. Transporting a minor out of state to your private island now becomes a federal crime, right? And so what the U.S. Attorney's Office did was said, we're going to enter into a deal in which we agree not to prosecute you for the federal crimes and let the state prosecute you for the state crimes. At the time, they had drafted up a 53-page indictment against Jeffrey Epstein. Now, you have seen the indictments that the Mueller report has released against all of the, you know, 30-odd various players that have been indicted.
Read them to me, yeah.
I don't think any of those, even the ones detailed, right, even the like 36-count indictment against Manafort that goes through all of the properties and bank accounts and everything, I don't think that one is 53 pages long. 53 pages long is extensive for an indictment, right? Because an indictment is just the statement of the charges against you.
The length of the indictment is quite an indictment about the dad joke. Yeah. One dad joke down.
All right. We get it's good to have a one dad out of joke one in dad this joke to get us through it. and then the state agreed a plea deal to the charge of soliciting a minor for prostitution. And he served 13 months at the Palm Beach County Stockade. While there, he was allowed to leave Stockade 6 days a week to work out of his office. So when people say unbelievable sweetheart deal, it's the combination, right? It is the Fed saying we won't prosecute you, we'll let the state prosecute you. And then the state turning around and instantly giving him a deal that is, preposterous for somebody who is.
I can't say anything for certain, but it reeks of corruption, you know, because doesn't he have a ton of ties to like pretty people pretty high up who may also be maybe potentially implicated in certain things?
Yep. All of that. And look, and he's a billionaire. And if you wanted to draw the inference that billionaires get preferential treatment in state court, this would be a really, really good piece of evidence to go with that. So at that time, right, as soon as the plea deal became public on July 7th, 2008. So, again, 10 and a half years ago. Two of Epstein's victims, and I want to point out there are dozens, there are potentially hundreds of victims. The as we are going to talk about when we do the in-depth discussion on a future episode, it is undisputed that there are dozens. So, two of his victims petitioned the court to enforce their rights under the Crime Victims' Rights Act of 2004. That statute is 18 U.S.C. Section 3771. I will link it in the show notes. So, yes, it has been 10 and a half years, and finally their rights were vindicated. But I want to describe sort of how limited those rights are. So that law grants 10 particular rights to victims of violent crime. And those rights include subsection A5, the reasonable right to confer with the attorney for the government in the case, and subsection 9, the right to be informed of a timely manner of any plea bargain or deferred prosecution agreement. So the allegation is that while the government was secretly negotiating the non-prosecution agreement with Epstein, that it did not inform and confer with the victims. And a court has now ruled that that is correct as a matter of law, that is indeed a fact. The government failed adequately to meet with the victims.
I'm sure the victims wouldn't be too happy with this absurdly sweetheart deal.
Yeah, correct. And that's the gravamen of their complaint. However, this is one of these situations where you have to look at both what rights the statute grants, but also the remedies as a result of those rights, right? So the statute itself contains a couple of limitations, right? Subsection D says, in no case shall a failure to afford a right under this chapter provide grounds for a new trial. A victim may make a motion to reopen a plea or sentence only if the victim has asserted the right to be heard before the proceeding at issue and such right was denied. The victim petitions for writ of mandamus within 14 days. And in the case of the plea, the accused has not pled to the highest offense charged. So in other words, the relief that you get for violation of this statute is very, very limited. And also critically, and this is going to come into play, I think, when we determine what the supplemental submissions are. D6 says, nothing in this chapter shall be construed to impair the prosecutorial discretion of the Attorney General or any officer under his direction. So the argument that the government has been making for 10 and a half years is, okay, maybe we violated their rights, but at the end of the day, we decided not to prosecute the guy, and deciding not to prosecute is something that the statute expressly allows us to do.
Yeah, but doesn't that render the statute pretty worthless?
It could. Okay. So let me tell you what the trial court judge has just issued a ruling. I'm going to upload it in the show notes. Again, it requires a supplemental submission by this afternoon, by the time you're listening to this, by tomorrow when we're recording it. They held a couple of things. So they held that, yes, the Crime Victims' Rights Act covers this kind of scenario, that it that those rights attach before you bring charges against a defendant, that it authorizes the reopening of a prosecutorial agreement, including a non-prosecutorial agreement, that the relief section, despite the fact that it talks about opening up a plea, could also mean reopening a non-prosecutorial agreement, and that the reasonable right to confer extends to the pre-charge state of criminal investigations and proceedings. So all of that really, really good news. And then I want to read kind of word for word what the judge says here. And this is Judge Mara, who says, lastly, the court will address the government's argument that prosecutorial discretion permitted it to enter into the agreement. The government correctly notes the section that I just read to you. This court is not ruling that the decision not to prosecute was improper. The court is simply ruling that, under the facts of this case, there was a violation of the victim's rights under the CVRA. So the court then orders that the attorneys for the victims and the government confer and inform the court within 15 days, like I said, that will be by tomorrow, how they wish to proceed on determining the issue of what remedy, quote, if any, should be applied in view of this violation, end of quote. I suspect the parties will not be able to reach an agreement, and then we will see a separate motion. The most that the victims can ask for in this case as a violation of the CVRA is that the non-prosecution agreement on the federal trafficking charges be torn up and that Epstein be indicted on sex trafficking charges. They cannot tear up and revisit the state agreement. They don't have jurisdiction. It's a separate case. The CVRA does not cover what happens in those state court proceedings. So those are the important takeaways here. And look, it would obviously be very, very good if Epstein is able to be charged on federal and international sex trafficking. The facts in the opinion strongly seem to support it. And given the number of victims and magnitude, you know, this could, you know, put him away for the rest of his life. That's what the victims are hoping for. But it's going to depend on what the trial court judge does. And you know, I read that section of the statute to you. He could say the remedy here is for the district attorney's office to come and confer with the victims, right? To belatedly grant you your CVRA rights and then enter into a new agreement. That could very well be the outcome. So that's the status. I thought it was worth clarifying because
there's been a lot of reporting. Maybe it was reported wrong. So do I have it right that worst case scenario, this could change almost nothing?
That is correct. Okay. It could change nothing.
Best case scenario, it could get him in prison for just the federal charges, not the state ones done.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. That's where we're.
Well,
so
I'll try to be optimistic, but
yeah, me too. So,
all right.
So well, there we go.
It is time for our co-favorite segment of the week. Try to get us back. Try to cheer us up a little bit from that.
Let's get
person.
Eli on to do like a goofy voice or, you know, whatever to cheer us all up. Before we go.
Just thank our top patrons, our Hall of Famers, our all-time greats over at patreon.com/law. I think that'll do it. Not only that, you guys, hopefully already as you're listening to this, have a lot of awful movies waiting for you.
Woo!
We covered the TV show, the new TV show called Proven Innocent. And boy, is it bad. So it's everything I hoped it would be. It's got Fraser Crane in it, and it sucks. So go check that out. It's real bad. All right. I'd like to thank, how can a clam cram in a clean cream can? Okay. Samuel Bland. I'd like to thank Um Brewing, California's first and only cooperatively owned brewery. Cool. I'd like to thank Jennifer Crack. Cratch or crack, I'm not sure. A 13th century Saxony gravel truck lawyer. The new Judge Dredd was good. Ooh, that sounds like we need to do a lot of awful movies. How much law was that? Herschel Ostepuller. Ostropuller? I don't know. Cut Maps. Bijou and Bangles. Custom and handcrafted jewelry. Stephen Baltikatai Sandoval. We're going to build a Death Star and make Alderaan pay for it. Stormy McKendrick, take my money, you filthy animals. Sign In Rap presents Duty to Read, a Saxony production. My watch is set to executive time. Dirk, Jeff Gelbach, John Bilderback, AFSPDaniel.com, support the overnight walk to #StopSuicide. Andrew will always be my precious little cinnamon bun for drugs. What? For drugs? Weird.
Oh, yeah. No, about drugs, right? Like that's a longstanding joke of when I walked into a room and there was certain aromas and I was like, why does it smell like skunk in here? And a certain mutual friend of ours labeled me a precious little cinnamon bun.
Gotcha. Republicans, not safe to vote for ever again. CivilPoliticsRadio.com, Fridays at 7 p.m. Eastern on Valley Free Radio. The Registry Matters podcast. Mueller is playing 3D Doritos while Trump is playing Cheeto Puffs. Came for the yodels, stayed for the intelligent legal analysis. Burbank Makerspace. When I was your age, we all took legal advice from podcasts and we... dot, dot, dot.
And we liked it.
Fox News. DataHack.com. Business automation making the menial automatic. An anagram of Trump's emergency wall is Mr. Twerp Menaces Gully. Kiowa Valley Exports for Australian red meat and craft beer. Thomas Smith is my favorite attorney. Andrew's a close second. A banana socialist democracy. Andrew, do you do divorces? Karen left me because of the bean thing. I don't know what that is, but I love that patron shout out. That's awesome. Michael Cohen is a no-talent ass clown. Blank Boxman, Kurt Robinson. Let me be totally clear. I like being totally clear. Schrodinger's Andrew is right and wrong at the same time. Cosmo needs better material blues. Getting off podcast. Sam Buck. Milo Meadsong, the Halfling Bard, and SIU 3L. We've confirmed still a 3L. E, sexy lady. Op, Gangnam Style. Cool. Karma Fleet supports both Lima and Wittertainment codes of conduct. Join your labor union. Together we bargain, alone we beg. Mike the Intactivist. Sending a check chiseled on a stone tablet. What is your Pony Express address? Polly Chuck. Rob Schreck. Buffering. And James. Thank you so much. Your turn.
And thank you to Asked About the P-Tape. Cohen replied, you're in luck. Unlimited Rice Pudding is tempting, but probably fatal. Cutting out the middleman to fund Eli's legal defense. Yeah, oh yeah. Anonymous. That's two anonymi. Buttercup's Legal Services is undefeated in court, 831, Cat Law 1. Some days even my lucky rocket ship underpants don't help. Yeah, tell me about it. Blank Box Woman, Andrew should be a permanent co-host on Skeptocrat. Well, you know where to send that. Advocatus Felis Catus. Lulu, doing yodel stuff. Yodel stuff is my favorite stuff. WordOrigins.org, if you're a 2,000-year-old dead Roman, the pronunciation is, and then it gets cut off. Roger Stone's self-destructive tendency. Liberal gun club, a pro Second Amendment voice for left of center gun owners. Neat. Behold, I am become millennial destroyer of industries boomer. Derek Terwilliger, I barely even know her. It's like I'm surprised it's taken somebody that long to make that joke. That's excellent. The official flag football team of opening arguments. Saul. Gam, live in Denver on my birthday. Yeah, I won't be there. Sorry. Big Easy Blasphemy, a string of unpronounceable characters. Zabby, enrage moping nuts is an anagram of opening arguments. Adam, Brandon Smith, what do we want? Time travel. When do we want it? That's irrelevant. I need to tell you, I have told my son that joke on three separate occasions since this the census patron has come in, and every time it's hilarious to me, and he's like, it's not that funny, Dad.
I'm
like, yeah, it's hilarious.
I'm with your son because like we still need time travel, you know, like if we don't get time travel until after we're dead, it doesn't really help us.
Yeah, well, you know.
So there you go.
Thomas and Aaron are doing Infinity War. Squee!
Oh, That's the kind of fun I will bring to Infinity War.
Oh, I can't wait. That's going to be your live blogging of Infinity War was a joy to behold. Rhonda is wearing her amicus briefs. Malaika Chandler, Abacus Flinch, a kilogram of Spiro Agnew is grave robbing. CampQuest.org, CampQuest.org, CampQuest.org. Jeremiah's Fancy Microwave Emporium, Soggy Pants, Squid Pro Crow, Sam Danow. Making Andrew shame laugh was the highlight of my week. Matthew Vernon, adopt a homeless pet and oppose declawing and ear docking. Blank or bust, blank is dumb. Or bust on anything is dumb, which, yeah, that's the whole point. Yes, we agree. Aaron Grady, not a pizza toppings Nazi. Yeah, no, I was really expecting more pizza-themed stuff this week. Ian and Allie, Sakashite Fukusumi has been mostly dead all week. St. Muller, patron saint of yodelers, Eli Bosnick, Mitchell, coming to theaters this fall, Taint Team 2, Seculo on this. That's it. Who rides the wrecking ball into our guitars? Andrew Lyrics, yeah. Conrad Mike Esquire, and notwithstanding the fact that that's a valiant effort, our all-time number one Hall of Famer, he who can never be caught, but keep trying, Conrad Michaels. Thank you all so much for supporting the show. We really appreciate it.
Good times. And now it's time for some TTTBE. I think I got the last one wrong. Let's see if I can get back on that horse. The correct question answering horse.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
All right, Thomas. This week's question. A group of students at a state university's law school wish to debate the future of affirmative action in that state and at that law school. For this debate, they requested the use of a meeting room in the law school that is available on a first-come, first-served basis for extracurricular student use. Speakers presenting all sides of the issue were scheduled to participate. The law school administration denied the use of its meeting room for this purpose solely because it believed that, quote, such a debate, even if balanced, would have a negative effect on the morale of the law school community and might cause friction among the students that would disrupt the institution's educational mission. End
this quote. Is a real Travis Wester question.
Yeah, it is. Is the law school's denial of the use of its meeting room for this purpose constitutional?
Wow.
Answers. A. No, because the law school cannot demonstrate that its action was necessary to serve a compelling state interest. B. No, because the law school cannot demonstrate that its action was rationally related to a legitimate state interest. C. Yes, because the law school's only concern was the adverse effect of such a discussion of affirmative action on the immediate audience and the mission of the institution. Or D, yes, because the law students do not have a right to use a state-owned law school facility for a meeting that is not organized and sponsored by the law school itself.
Oh, tough one. I was hoping it would be a little more recognizable. I wasn't sure. I was hoping for some wording that might include, you know, limited use, public, whatever the heck it was. Okay, let's try to get the details here. State university, law school, debate. And they've requested use of a meeting room in the law school that is available on a first come first serve basis for extracurricular student use. Well, this is going to be really tough. I'm mad if I can't get this one because we've talked about this so much. It doesn't seem like it's necessarily like a public forum per se. Like it's not out there in the quad or that kind of thing, but it also seems to be a meeting room that is available first come, first serve for students. It's also, I'm wondering if it matters that the speakers are presenting all sides of the issue. I don't know that that matters. Like, would it be different if it's only one side? You know, maybe it's only a pro, let's see, it's only a pro affirmative action or something like that, and then they silenced them. Would that be different than saying, we don't even want a debate on this? Oh, man. What a tough one. Okay. A, no, because the law school cannot demonstrate that its action was necessary to serve a compelling state interest. B, no, the law school cannot demonstrate that its action was rationally related to a legitimate state interest. Okay. Of those ones, I'm going to go ahead and say that I like A better, because if we're taking things at face value here, I would say preserving, it's a state university, so preserving the morale of the law school community, I think that could be a legitimate state interest. But if I were to go with a no answer, I think I would rather say A, because maybe you would say it's, well, that's not a compelling state interest though. That's not, that doesn't over, you know, the override the right to free speech kind of thing. I'm kind of leaning toward a no answer, but I'm not super in love with those. Let's see what the yes answers are. And that is the law school's denial of the use of its meeting room for this purpose constitutional? So I was leaning toward no, but let's see. Yes, because the law school's only concern was the adverse effect of such a discussion of affirmative action on the immediate audience of the, and the mission of the institution. I mean, maybe could be that. D, yes, because the law students do not have a right to use a state-owned law school facility for a meeting that is not organized and sponsored by the law school itself. So I think no on D. I'm going to say no on D because it seems to me when we talk about these things, it sort of has to do with like what's the room typically used for. You know, you can't say, well, it's open to whoever, first come, first serve, and then when something you don't like is happening, be like, no, this is just, never mind, it's only law school faculty or whatever. So I don't think it's D. I'm really leaning toward A or C. So either is this a compelling state interest or yes, because the law school's only concern was the adverse effect of such a discussion of affirmative action on the immediate audience and the mission of the institution. I think hopefully I'm doing my issue spotting right, and that is the question. So A would be like, yeah, that's legitimate, and C would be, A would be, no, that's not legitimate enough to stop this, and then C would be, yes, it is. You know, I'm really, you know, I'm mad that I'm probably going to get this one wrong. I think I'm going to go toward A, no, because the law school cannot demonstrate that its action was necessary to serve a compelling state interest. I just think, based on what we've talked about, it does seem like the law is pretty, you know, protective of free speech in this way. And I'm going to go with A. Final answer.
All right. And if you'd like to play along with Thomas, you know how to do that. Just share out this episode on social media. Include the hashtag TTTBE. Include your answer, your reasons, therefore. And we will pick a winner and shower that person with never ending fame and fortune. Fame and fortune not guaranteed.
All righty. Thanks so much for listening. And thanks most of all to our patrons for making the show happen. Enjoy that Lot Awful Movies. And of course the Q&A audio. If you missed our video Q&A, that's the audio's there for patrons, all that good stuff. Thank you all and see you next time.
You betray the law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the assistance of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, our production assistant, Ashley Smith, and our researcher, Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez and the entire OA Wiki team. Follow them at OA Wiki. And a big thank you to our Facebook group moderators, Alicia Cook, Natalie Newell, Emily Waters, Eric Brewer, and Brian. Check out the Opening Arguments Facebook community. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith for creating the show's theme song, which is used with permission.
Sorry, let me go back to my deep third.